Hello, I'm Guy Foster, and after a crazy first month of 2021, I'm delighted to have had the opportunity to speak to Joe Amato, the CIO of $400 billion asset manager Neuberger Berman. But bear in mind that we can't guarantee sources from outside Brewin Dolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change. And remember, obviously, when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and performance in the future can differ from that of the past. So Neuberger Berman have a host of traditional and alternative investment strategies. This is a good opportunity to find out what things like the GameStop debacle meant and will mean for those trying to run long short money. So bear with us and we'll get straight into this podcast in just a few moments. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Brewin podcast. On this occasion, we're delighted to have as our guest, the CIO of Neuberger Berman Asset Management, Joe Amato. So, Joe, welcome to the podcast and thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here, Guy. Thank you very much for having me and love the partnership we have with you and your organization.
Brilliant. Well, look, there's so much we could ask you, but I guess I think what's on everyone's minds at the moment, we had a bit of a wobble in the market last week, but it didn't really turn into very much. It's been, you know, we've had a few straight months of really strong markets. If we look at the economy, I think every indication is that this is an economy that is close to the beginning of an expansion. When we look at the market, it sometimes feels a bit more like there's a bit of irrational exuberance going on, or certainly some people are seeing signs of that. So I just wondered if I could use that very vague premise to kind of get you to give us your view of how you kind of reconcile those points.
Sure. So I think we are, Guy, on the verge in the early stages of economic expansion as we recover from, of course, the unique experience that we've all had in 2020. So, you know, the working through the virus, the vaccine distribution, the economic reopening, the pent-up demand that I think we do see, and the economic stats are all suggesting that we are in that early stage of development. At the same time, because of the enormous amounts of monetary and now fiscal stimulus that's come into the system back in 20 and continues, there's probably been some element of pull forward of that market recovery, right, that you might have taken a bit longer in a more typical type economic recovery, that because of the enormous amounts of excess liquidity, you've seen that money put to work. And on the edges, you know, we as we saw in the past week or two, definitely some frothiness, and that's a cause for some concern, but with a long-term outlook, we're still constructive on the equity asset class.
Yeah, well, as you say, you alluded to a bit of frothiness over the last week or two. I mean, I think one of the indications of that was obviously what happened with GameStop, which I think was a stock that suddenly all of our friends who have nothing to do with the finance industry were suddenly ringing us up and asking about and things like that. So, I mean, that does sometimes mark a bit of a frothy kind of bubble type phenomenon. And I guess given your unique experience as the head of an asset manager with some, you know, plenty of alternative strategies as well, I'd really like to take this opportunity to get your perspective on it. So, I mean, I guess everybody understands the basic premise here. Some investors were short GameStop. Some investors felt that the short thesis was wrong. And given that it was so heavily shorted, they kind of felt like they could take GameStop short sellers hostage and really force them to buy back their shares at a much higher price. Now, I mean, that hasn't happened, as it turns out. And so I wonder if you could tell us, I mean, what do you think? Was there a problem in that thesis?
Well, I think first thing I point out is, like, so at Neuberger, we didn't play in any of those stocks. We weren't long, we weren't short.
I was going to ask you about that. Okay,
so
fine.
So, but as it relates to my observation as a third party looking at the situation, I think it was quite a unique confluence of factors. You have, you know, very low transaction costs, I think a fair amount of boredom on the parts of retail investors. You have the government cutting pretty big checks to people, and you know, you had that sort of swarm, if you will, get focused on a couple of individual stocks that, you know, we scratched our head and just couldn't understand and couldn't reconcile the underlying fundamentals, which on those companies are still quite challenging, with the price action. And, you know, I've been around long enough to know that when you encounter situations like that, you kind of take a step back and you get out of the way. And I'm glad that we didn't own any of those stocks, so we didn't have to even do that. But you know, when fundamentals seem not to matter and you don't know what's driving, you know, stocks like that, it's kind of scary. And the thing that we worried about most was the hedge fund deleveraging. So clearly it was a hedge fund phenomenon, both in terms of many who were short that stock and, as we've learned in subsequent days, many hedge funds had actually made a significant return in those stocks. It wasn't just retail investors who made and lost money. But we worried more about the deleveraging, right? So, and the degrossing that typically goes on, you know, when hedge funds see the same phenomenon I just referenced, which is, hey, I don't understand what's going on. I just got to degross. And that has often led to more volatility and a contagion effect. It seemed to be isolated. In retrospect, it didn't have that contagion effect. You saw a blip in the market, as you referenced, Guy, but some of that shakeout has occurred, and it didn't have broader impact. And as we've seen markets rally here in the last, you know, 3-4 days, as folks have, you know, sort of refocused on some of the things we talked about at the top of our discussion, you know, the underlying economic data. And while again, near term, there's certainly still hugely unfortunate, you know, sort of virus deaths and impact. The vaccine distribution is sloppy and inconsistent, but ultimately markets are seeing through that to look at, you know, what is the recovery going to look like.
So do you have, do any of your colleagues at Neuberger invest in that way, in that sort of special situation way? Because as you say, it was, the fundamentals clearly didn't justify the price towards the end, at least. It was started off as a fundamental disagreement, but then later it became a technical point, like these guys have got to close their shorts, so as long as we hold all the stock, they won't be able to, and the price will just keep going up. So I know that there are many long only and hedge fund investors who will invest on the basis of special situations, maybe not ones quite like that, but do any of your colleagues run anything like that?
So we certainly pride ourselves on being long-term focused investors, you know, looking at the underlying fundamentals, but you can't ignore some of these short-term issues. And there are at times where we've got, you know, some of our teams that are going to be involved with stocks that have an element of momentum to them, right? So if I look at our exposure to, if you will, the momentum factor, it's higher today than it was 3 years ago. You know, what's working, and, you know, people sort of pile on to a certain degree. So I don't, you know, we have such a diversification of strategies. I don't overly worry about, you know, our exposure to momentum broadly within the firm. We've had situations where, you know, folks have, you know, gotten either on the long or short side of situations, not as extreme as, you know, the kind of the craziness we saw in GameStop and AMC and a couple others, but certainly, you know, we, like the overall market, I think has gotten swept up in growth. And I think, you know, the indices, if you look at the U.S. indices, they're far growthier today than they were 5 years ago. And I, you know, I often encourage clients who have, you know, often exposure to passive as well as active, just, you know, if you're exposed to the indices, particularly the large cap broad-based U.S. indices, just appreciate the level of momentum and growth you have exposure to. And it, you know, that dynamic I think is quite relevant as you think now about the value rotation and the debate around, you know, how, you know, what sort of legs there are to that value rotation. And you don't want to get off sides by being, you know, very little exposed to value when it has a powerful recovery, which we think there will be. You know, I think the debate in our mind on value is how long is it going to last.
Yeah. And just so just one final question then, with the on the subject of this of the froth of last week, but when you are running long short money, and with the, given the sort of chain reaction that went through the market, obviously if you were short GameStop you had a real problem, but then we could see that some things that people were long got sold due to the degrossing that you were talking about, which, as you say, didn't happen on a huge scale, but it clearly did start to kind of ripple through the market. I mean, so does it cause anxiety? Does it change the way that that you look at how you run long short money, and particularly obviously this phenomenon, this Wall Street Bets, Reddit, whatever you want to call it, this retail phenomenon, the action of Robin Hood, has that created a whole new force, which now for the foreseeable future, you need to be kind of wary of?
I think it absolutely does, Guy. And I think it's a great point, important point that if you think about the hedge fund that, you know, unfortunately, you know, for their clients, you know, was down 50-something% and got caught. It's hedge fund with a good track record, and we know some of those folks, they're really smart, they're good investors, and they just got off sides and, you know, get sort of carried out. I mean, it's pretty pretty extraordinary. So I think, you know, being more careful on your on the short side, probably having smaller short positions, probably more disciplined risk management. No pun intended here, but more disciplined stops in your short, because as we know, shorts have unlimited, you know, upside or downside depending on the perspective you think of.
And the risk grows as they go against you, doesn't it?
Exactly. So just a greater level of discipline, particularly on the short side. I'm not sure it necessarily changes your long investing. Maybe a quicker sort of degrossing if you see markets moving side, you know, moving against you, which, you know, is not a great phenomenon, because it's just leading to that much more short-term kind of trading activity.
Yeah.
And like I said, our old underlying culture, while we have long short strategies that as you guys well know, it goes against kind of everything we think about, even in Steve's strategy, right? He's more of a long-term oriented investor, but it does require you to be that much more disciplined on the short side. In my view, have smaller shorts and be quicker to cover if need be.
Steve Eisman, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Steve,
right. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then, I mean, you were going on obviously then to talk a little bit more about some of the, I guess the risks that investors are running here. And so not having enough exposure to value at this time, I suppose, when you've had such strong outperformance of growth, you'd see that as quite a sort of meaningful potential mistake that investors could make.
Well, I think, growth has been, of course, what's working and has worked for past 10 years or plus. So many, many investors have gotten, you know, over, I don't know if we say overexposed, but certainly significantly exposed to growth, and just almost by definition underexposed to value. In a cyclical recovery, historically, that's when you want to play value, right? When that acceleration is occurring. And things like financials and industrials and materials and energy, et cetera, are all more sensitive, of course, to economic growth. And that's when you play them in the cycle. And you tend to play growth when the cycle's slowing, because you have secular growth within those companies or those sectors. So in our view, value and cyclicals do make sense to increase one's exposure to. And then if you think about it geographically, like the European markets are more cyclical. The Japanese market is more cyclical. EM is more cyclical. Yeah. So it's a bit of, you know, reduce your exposure US, which has been working and been the place to invest the last dozen years, and increase your exposure. You have on top of that the dollar that's clearly, obviously it's weakened. We expect it to further weaken. We don't expect it to collapse, but, you know, that bodes well for investing in non-US assets. So I think these two things come together. And then the last thing, Guy, I would mention, which is probably a whole, you know, question we should touch on in more depth, is inflation. And if you do expect to pick up inflation, driven by a series of factors, most significant of which would be accelerating economic activity, you know, that also bodes well for, you know, things like financials and cyclicals.
Well, I'm interested. Yeah, I'm really interested in your view on that. I mean, we can see some inflation, but it's sort of base effects because oil was so low last year. We can see clear evidence of inflation in things like the PMI indices that's related to supply chain difficulties. But I guess the question is any of that the kind of enduring inflation that that I think is the kind that you're alluding to, that is a reflection of strong demand rather than just sort of technical difficulties?
Yeah. So I think you're absolutely right. In the near term, you will have the annualization effect, in particular in March and April, where the year-to-year comparisons are going to be quite easy, if you will, for inflation. So you'll see an uptick in the reported numbers because of that effect. I think that's pretty well understood in the markets. Sometimes you always get surprised that, you know, when you print a number that's higher, folks get anxious about it. But I think there's a lot of expectation that that's going to occur. The larger question in our mind is this year really the point of inflection for inflation? And if you look at what we've experienced over the past, you know, cycle, which is enormous monetary stimulus that has led to financial asset inflation, but not real world inflation. And now you have significant fiscal policy. And the question in our minds, and we think it will, does that lead to real world inflation? And I know there are lots of skeptics because, you know, as everyone says, the central bankers, the Fed, ECB, everybody's been targeting higher inflation, and they keep talking about it, and they never meet their inflation goal, and they always fall short.
But also, as you alluded to earlier, you know, some of this fiscal stimulus is checks being sent to people that's going into asset price inflation or just being saved, you know, it's being saved one way or the other as well.
Yeah, and I think when people are locked down in their apartments and their houses, like, you're pushing on a string to a degree. You're sending, you know, this latest fiscal plan that the U.S. is debating is going to send $1,400 checks to folks, and it's hard to spend that when you can't leave your apartment. So, you know, I think that leads to that sort of point I made earlier around pent-up demand, that when there is that reopening, we think folks, that savings rate, which peaked at 30-something percent in the U.S. back in the spring, and probably we'll see an uptick in savings rate, you know, in this latest fiscal initiative, you know, that is going to come down. Right, you're not going to sustain a savings rate that high, and now that doesn't mean that we're going to see runaway inflation, but if you see inflation in the high twos or the threes, I think you have to think through what your asset allocation and what your investment focus is going to be in that sort of environment. I don't think the central bankers are going to rush to raise rates to deal with a 3% inflation rate. And I think that effective financial repression that they'll get by keeping rates low, letting inflation run hot, and sort of growing out of the debt burden, right? If you look at the U.S. debt burden, to achieve pre-virus or, excuse me, pre-pandemic debt levels, to go back to those levels, you would have to have enormous tax increases or enormous spending reductions or unbelievable growth. And just those three things aren't going to happen, right? So, how do you get out of this debt burden? I think a lot of that debt's going to be permanent, but I think a level of financial repression, of forcing, you know, rates to stay low and let inflation run hotter is effectively the policy that's being instituted.
And so that would normally that kind of a fiscal boost like that would normally be, as you kind of hinted at earlier, a kind of ring a bell for value investors to take advantage. And I guess the sector that's normally in the crosshairs of that is the financials and the banks, which really benefit from that steepening yield curve. But when you talk about financial repression, you're basically talking about yields not being allowed to rise as much as they would otherwise. So, I mean, what does that, where does that leave the opportunity set for the value investor wanting to take advantage of a financial repression driven increase in inflation?
Well, I think it bodes well for stocks. As I half jokingly remind people, good, companies report revenue and earnings in nominal dollars, not real dollars.
Yeah, yeah.
So, inflation, they're in a position to benefit from that level of, operating leverage that naturally gets, that is inherently in the system as top line increases at a higher rate. So I think exposure to those sectors that would benefit from, higher nominal levels of growth, again, important question in our minds is how sustainable that growth is, because I do worry, once that cyclical recovery occurs in the next couple of years, what do you go back to? And I think you may go back to a level of secular stagnation and slower levels of grinding growth. But I don't want to sound Pollyannish, but there'll be a time to worry about that. It's not necessarily now to worry about that, because we're still in this economic reopening phase, and the boost, like in U.S. GDP growth, I'm seeing numbers 4%, 5%, 6%, real growth in 21, and sort of that momentum rolling into 22, maybe in the 3% or 4% growth level, which is levels we haven't seen in a long, long time. If you go back to 1.5 to 2 thereafter, we need to think about that. And there, during that kind of environment, you probably want to go back to some of the secular growers and that have worked well in the past number of years. But like I said, I think there's a time and a place that we'll have to worry about that. As it relates to financials, Guy, I think, financials have actually proven to be pretty adept at dealing with a pretty flat curve. And it's not like financials earnings haven't grown and they haven't printed some very attractive numbers, right? And if you have a stronger economy, lower losses from in their credit book, releasing of reserves, that I think bodes well for what is probably the most depressed from a valuation standpoint sector you have in markets. And I think, there's many differences, right? European financials, I think, have a different dynamic than U.S. financials. I think U.S. financials are probably in better shape than European financials are. But nonetheless, I think it will bode well for financials, which have been, out of favor for so long. It's been pretty amazing.
What do you think? That sounds like a pretty benign environment to be investing early in the economic cycle, loose liquidity, big earnings growth, big GDP growth. So what should investors be worried about in this environment, or should they not, or is there nothing to worry about?
I'm a natural worrier, as most investors are. So, always thinking about, what can go wrong. I think let's think about it. If you go down the list, so one is this virus has proven to be quite stubborn, right? So we don't know yet on some of the mutations how effective vaccines will be, what the uptake is, when we'll reach herd immunity. I think we'll get there. Our biotech team feels that even the Brazilian and South African strain, that the vaccines will be reasonably effective, not as effective as the UK and the core strain, but will be effective. And some of the other treatments have proven to be reasonably effective against the Brazilian and South African strain. So we'll get through that. But of course, that's our view, right? That is based on judgment, right? We could be wrong. Then there is, go back to the question of rates and inflation. So I think that's the most important thing that we need to focus on and worry about, because a big uptick in rates or inflation, either a policy mistake. I don't think the policymakers are going to be quick to raise rates, because if you or I were Jay Powell or running another big central bank, last thing we'd want to be is blamed for squelching a global economic recovery. So I think they're going to let rates or keep rates low for a long time.
But for the record, I'd just relish the opportunity. But anyway, yeah, carry on.
That would be quite a hot seat, though, to be on.
Yeah, it always seems nicer from the outside, I guess.
Yeah. But you know, the market, remember the term, again, I'm old enough to remember the term bond market vigilantes.
Yeah.
So, you know, the bond market doesn't, is not controlled by the Fed, right? So, you know, there could be increases in rates, whether it's credit spreads, credit rates, non-sovereign, right? Again, I think the central bankers will try hard to probably buy every bond they could possibly to keep rates low. But an increase in rates that choke off, you know, a more sustained recovery and inflation running. Again, I don't want to say out of control. I'm not talking about inflation like we saw in the 70s. It's something to watch closely and probably is the biggest issue that we're worried about. Thirdly, I would then throw out also valuation. So go back to the kind of top of our discussion, right, which is frothiness, valuations. Is that a catalyst for concern? Valuations are stretched. We can say that about every single asset class, just about, you know, in the globe, in every market. And when rates are where they are, you know, I think that's what you're going to get. But valuations are something that we want to watch. And, you know, I would say broad-based, if I think back to the experience we had in 99, 2000, 2001, there was much more pervasive valuation frothiness. Here, you can look at some of the technology companies, the software SaaS companies, some of the craziness we talked about with, you know, the activity levels in GameStop. You see some of the SPAC activity. You know, there's clearly plenty of frothiness, but it's not necessarily as broad-based. And I don't, you know, if I look at the U.S. market, which is probably where you have the most excess valuation, you know, if you're at low 20s PE and you got a, you know, 10-year treasury in the low ones, it's not crazy to think that with treasuries where they are and the risk-free rate where it is, the equity risk premium is not necessarily at levels that would cause huge concern.
Okay, well, so if I just I'll let you get away, but if I could just ask you one more question before I let you go. I guess it's been amazing how powerful the policy response has been to COVID. And I'm talking about the financial response really more than the health response. But it's been so dramatic. And I suppose looking at it, it looks like a lot of it starts to resemble more a lot of what some commentators have been calling for, which is a different approach to economic management, a kind of the terms modern monetary theory, where the Fed does explicitly manipulate the yield curve, where the debt level doesn't matter as long as the investment is productive. Or universal basic income, you know, following this kind of disbursement of checks to Americans. So, you know, is there something, and you referred earlier to the beyond this rebound, what happens after that? Do you sense that there is anything building, any change, any sort of political will to accept any of these things that have been sort of talked about ad nauseum in little corners of the Twitter sphere and stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, so, Guy, if you and I were sitting here last January, I think I was one of the people joking about MMT, about how crazy it was, and that, you know, the notion you could just print money forever and throw, you know, helicopter money at everybody and everything's wonderful, and, you know, some hard left liberal end of the political spectrum in the U.S. were promoting that, and many economists and financial types like me were saying that's nutty, that there is a limit to that. In reality, as we look fast forward a year, we're sitting here in February of 2021, effectively we've gone from QE to MMT, right? QE was the policy for the last 10 years. And, you know, the question is what, you know, is MMT going to last a lot longer? And if you look at the levels of government debt in the U.S. Just let's stick with the U.S. as the biggest example. You're at 100% debt to GDP. You'll be at 120%, 130% based on, you know, the projection of of deficits over the next few years. And that's probably manageable. And I'm not saying that US could get to where Japan is, because I think Japan has a lot of very unique characteristics that have allowed it to run debt levels that it has. And it's one of the kind of unknowables. I mean, I don't have any great insight for you and your team in that. I don't think it's sustainable. You can say in a half-joking way, half-serious way, that if you have the printing press and the army, you have control of the printing press and the army, I guess you can keep, you know, keep that printing press rolling. But at some point, the market's got to react to the enormous increase in debt levels. I liken it to, you know, a company, you know, a private sector company that used to be AAA, that increased leverage and is now running at single A or triple B. Yeah, they can do that. Markets will fund it. But if that credit were to go to single B, or they have a blip and or another exogenous event, you know, do the markets continue to fund that? And, you know, I wish I had the answer to that. I don't. I think there will be a growing view in the U.S. in the political spectrum that you can't continue to have unlimited levels of debt. But I don't think the toleration to increase taxes enormously. I think the Biden administration will increase taxes in corporates and individuals. That's one of the things we haven't even touched on that I think will be a little bit of a headwind for U.S. markets. Mm. Not enormous, but a U.S. modest headwind. Basically, every 1% increase in the corporate rates, about $1 a share in S&P 500 earnings. So that'll give you a sense that if that rate goes up 5 or 7 points, it's not the end of the world, right? When you're going from 140 in S&P earnings to 170 or 80, you know, in the course of the next year or two. Yeah. You know, that is, many economists are going to write books about, you know, the level of U.S. debt and MMT. But I just don't, you know, I'm still, maybe call me old school. I just don't think you could just keep printing money and giving it to people. It's just not a sustainable approach.
Okay, well, you might need to let some of your representatives know that then before it's too late. Okay, yes. Joe. Well, look, thanks so much for taking us through all that. Really appreciate your perspective. Thanks very much, and thanks also to all of our listeners for joining us for this. Hopefully, you've enjoyed this Bruin podcast, and hopefully, you will join us again next time.
Thanks.